You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Rogue. Each week, we design spicy new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the roundup, a tournament report with Red-Green Kiora in Pioneer. Then on the flashback, our testing results with Crested Sunmare. Finally, on the brew session, we are igniting the fires of invention in Modern and Pioneer. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 34 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, coming to you from the frigid north of Minneapolis. Joined, as always, by my guy on the left coast. He is Nuke Launch Online. He is Damon Alexander, coming straight out of Seattle. Damon, what's going on?
Hey, it's a little chilly here too, but probably not as cold as Minnesota. It's rainy though, which takes it to another level. How cold is it over there?
The high today was like 2. I think tomorrow is going to be 0. And then it'll be back up in the 20s for the weekend at least.
Oh.
Yeah, it's pretty miserable. I had to jump a couple of my employees' cars because they didn't start. You know, a lot of young kids right out of college don't have the best battery in their vehicle. It's just something Minnesotans like to do, bitch about the weather. So it's that time of year. Joining us, as always, is the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Caveman Online. Dan Schriever, what's going on?
I'm doing well. I played my first paper Pioneer tournament over the weekend, and I won my first 3 matches of Pioneer. Unfortunately, it was more than a 3-round tournament, but it started well. And then I lost my first 3 matches of Pioneer, and here we are.
All right.
You mean you lost your last 3 matches of Pioneer?
I got my first 3 paper losses in Pioneer after my first 3 paper wins in Pioneer.
Yeah.
It's like the tournament never happened at all.
Yeah. The sine wave has rebalanced itself. So before we get too deep into the results of the past week, we want to give a quick shout out to all of our new patrons. We had quite a few. Big thank you to Bradley W., Bradford S., Jonathan W., Terry P., Sean F., Brandon F., and Spot Red. Thank you very much for your contributions. We'll welcome you to the Discord. Yeah, we just really appreciate it.
Also want to give a quick shout out to Ben E. for increasing their pledge. I mentioned that it would really help us out a lot if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or on iTunes, if you could leave us a review. That really helps people who are new to the show get a feel for whether they want to check us out. We did get some friendly reviews on Apple Podcasts, so I want to give a quick thanks to MStep305, All for Delilah, Met Sophie, Conacab, iStock5, Josh Eli, CFP, and M1 Loose. Thank you very much for the kind words. We really appreciate that. And if you'd like to join our Patreon, patreon.com/faithlessbrewing is the place.
What do we call it? The place to be. So this weekend, Dan, you had your maiden voyage into the paper world of Pioneer. There have not been that many actual paper tournaments of Pioneer. You decided to play a red-green Kiora list similar to the one I proposed, I think, in week one of our Pioneer days weeks ago. What was your impressions of the format?
I should mention that this tournament was a Star City Games IQ, and we have a lot of these in my area. They're always Modern. There's a huge Modern scene regulars. We look forward to this 2-3 weekends a month. This one was also a Modern tournament until suddenly it wasn't. It was a little bit of a shock to have to suddenly come up with a deck. That being said, this was right after the last major round of bannings, so the metagame was somewhat unknown. I faced off against mono red aggro, mono black aggro, some mid-range decks, like an energy mid-range. I won those matchups quite comfortably with this red-green Kiora deck that we've been kicking around. It turns out that I built it to be very strong against aggro or midrange, but I discovered then that I actually didn't have quite enough juice for the other matchups, so my losses were to Is It Phoenix, Blue-White, Approach of the Second Sun, and a Teemer midrange that was basically the same deck I was playing, but with the food engine, with Okos and Wicked Wolves.
Yeah, the paper Pioneer meta seems to be way, way more open than the online Pioneer meta. I sent my team trio's companion into battle with a blue-white control list that I saw top-8 the PTQ under the hands of Squat Chief. He played against a Bant Company, some Teemer Walker's deck, a Jeskai mid-range deck. It seems like in paper, every match is against a different deck, whereas online, the meta seems to be much more insular.
Yeah, especially in the PTQs and things, I think the tryhards, if you will, they're all just spamming whatever. They don't want to try anything new. They just want to run whatever Jerry or someone else has had success with. Maybe the people playing paper had the same concerns you did, Dan. They didn't want to buy into the format yet, so they were sort of forced to play whatever Pioneer deck they had available to them before actually investing in the quote-unquote best deck.
Oh, it was definitely that. I mean, everyone that I talked to was in the same boat. Like, what decks can we build? A, what do we want to play? But choosing from the narrow set of decks that we actually have the cards for. So there was a lot of scrambling. I wanted to play like a Teemer build that splashed the food engine. It was like the whole village came together. I borrowed an Oko here, another Oko there. Like everyone chipped in an Oko, but I just couldn't find any Gilded Goose. No one's buying and selling standard cards. So no one had Gilded Geese anywhere. None of the stores had them.
What you're describing is something I've read multiple tweets and references to. Like, paper standard has basically collapsed. Huge PTQs, like in Toronto, etc., have now had 20 people show up to PTQs that they used to have 400 people at. Obviously, standard, very successful in the arena sphere, in the electronic sphere, in the esports sphere, but perhaps at the expense of paper. And I think that's the availability of these cards is going to become a problem if they're going to keep making standard sets that are so powerful that, I mean, I don't even know how many cards from Eldraine are modern playable, 15, 25, 35. If that's their new power target, paper has to at least sell enough cards for us to be able to construct the list in modern legacy at times and pioneer.
Yeah, well, the good news with that, Dave, is that if you had built the Simic ramp deck that terrorized standard for a while, you could actually just convert that into this new green-blue devotion deck that's perhaps the new bane of Pioneer by simply adding some Nykthos and Walking Ballistas and Hydroid Crises. But you already have your Geese and your Okos and your Nissas.
You just need to buy, like, some lands.
Exactly.
Tell us a little bit about this Simic devotion deck. This was kind of the story of the weekend.
The basic shell was first proposed, it sounds like, Jerry Thompson. He is also in the Arena Decklist podcast. He has his own Discord, and he proposed this list, and it sounds like several people adopted it and had tremendous success. Yama Killer won the PTQ. Emma Handy top four two different PTQs. And the one that she top four is the same one that Yama Killer won. And then a third person was also in that top four. So three of the top four slots were this blue-green list. It's very similar to the mono-green list that Todd Anderson was kind of terrorizing Pioneer within the early days. So it's playing the 8-mana creatures, no longer playing Once Upon a Time. But instead of playing sort of like beater creatures, the 3-drop of choice is Oko. And then it tries to go up to Wicked Wolf, Nissa, Hydroid Crisis, and Walking Ballista. I think there were like 2 Heart of Kirin's in there as well, and maybe like 1 Scavenging Ooze.
The food engines, Oko, Wicked Wolf, and Gilded Goose, seem to be taking the spots that were previously occupied by like Burning Tree Emissary, Voracious Hydra, Vivian. But the Nissa core, the Nissa and the Mana Elves and the Nykthos, that remains. So you have the ability to just go over the top, snowball a game very easily.
Yeah, the interesting thing is there actually aren't that many forests in the deck. So Nissa isn't that huge of a mana engine. She's more just an ability to like crap out a ton of 3/3s. I think the deck was really well positioned for that particular metagame because the Wolf is so good against aggro. And I think a lot of people thought that they could play red again because a mono black and green list weren't going to be as consistent because of Once Upon a Time being gone. And that is true. They're not as consistent. This deck is much worse than the mono green list that was dominating Pioneer. But Wicked Wolf is so good against all these crappy aggro creatures. It's a brick wall and it's not totally dead against control lists because you can't wrath it away. That particular choice was an insane call to play that over the Hydra. Jerry at least seemed to really understand kind of what people would want to play and how best to combat it.
I'm not convinced that this is actually weaker than the original Mono Green Devotion. It's a little more versatile. 4 Okos and 4 Wicked Wolves answers a wider swath of things than the Ballista and Hydra.
Yeah, I mean, the Oko Nissa Hydroid Crisis centerpiece of the deck is just such a good engine at handling so many parts of Magic. Oko handles large creatures. He manages your life total. Puts on pressure alone. Nissa takes over a game in very few turns while simultaneously setting up your mana. And then also out of your sideboard, this deck plays up to 6 counterspells. And Nissa's really good at letting you safely tap out for her while keeping up your shields in the same way that Big Teferi 5 does.
And I should amend my statement. This also has Ballista, but it doesn't have the Voracious Hydra and it doesn't have the Vivians or the Burning Tree Emissaries. Maybe those scale higher up the curve. When you're really doing it with a lot of mana, you can get more out of those. But when you're not, when you're fighting more of a mid-range back and forth game, I think this food engine with the Okos and the Wicked Wolves will go a long way towards beating people punch for punch, and then suddenly once they let up, you'll just run away with it.
Yeah, it seems like this is maybe analogous to Modern when we had this Urza Were deck, and then Team Lotus Box is like, actually, this deck is better if we just jam a bunch of Okos and Gilded Geese into it. And all of a sudden we have Simic Urza, which has been Modern's biggest deck meta-wise in the last few tournaments. This evolution of Green Devotion into why not just jam a bunch of Okos into it is perhaps something similar, and the Hydroid Krasis really helps win the kind of mid-game battle, as opposed to the super explosive BT, Vivian, and then next turn Ulamog type thing.
I mean, this list basically existed when Mono Green was a thing, and Mono Green murdered it, so I think you guys, I disagree respectfully is I guess what I'm going to say. And I played against both of those in the early days of Pioneer as well, and Blue Green definitely has maybe the more varied way of interacting, but you just have a chance to beat them just playing fair things, and you did not have a chance to do that against the mono-green list.
Perhaps the slightly more non-linear blue-green deck is better in a world without Once Upon a Time. Once Upon a Time really enabled the straight linear strategy of mono-green.
I think you hit the nail right on the head. That's exactly right.
I'll mention that this is also the deck that won the event that I was at. The tournament was on a Sunday, and this list kind of broke on Twitter late on Saturday, and I realized I was exactly 2 Gilded Geese short of building it, so I couldn't quite make the mana work. But still in hand, the SCG writer, he ended up going undefeated with this build. He was the only person in the room who successfully assembled the cards.
Great tournament where card restriction determines the ultimate winner.
Well, Pioneer meta moves fast. I mean, the banning was only a week ago and there were no major tournaments. So
yeah,
this Glimpse into Challenges has been our biggest meta update ever for this version of Pioneer.
So is there any news in the modern world that you gentlemen feel like is worth reporting?
Eldrazi Tron.
Yeah.
Just a lot of that. Every tournament you play, I think you should expect to see that deck. Tron seems to be completely supplanted by it. Looking at the challenge results, there's a healthy or unhealthy mix of Eldrazi Tron, Grixis Shadow, and then Amulet Titan. I'm taking the top slots.
You played Modern this weekend.
Yeah. It was only 4 rounds before my team got out of there. I played Niv to Light because obviously I love that deck. And I went 3-1, lost to Eldrazi Tron, but then I beat Devoted Druid, Bant, Snow Control, and then I finished a match 1-0 against 4-color Shadow.
So I have a question about this Bant Snow Control. It seems to be the default list that all the people who are playing were Urza, and then they were playing, whatever, Simic mid-range Urza, and then Canister even moved to this Bant Urza. And to me, it just seems like they keep making the list less and less proactive, almost worse in a way, and they're no longer finishing at the top of any of these tournaments. Is everyone just way too smart for their own good with this list, or what's happening?
I think that there's 2 Bant Snow decks. One is this Urza deck that Canister played in the challenge, and I'm not super familiar with it, but it seems kind of like the Simic Urza deck, but just with more Teferis.
Right, yep.
Then there's the Bant Control deck that I think Mick Winsaw's piloted to a top finish in a challenge, and this is more an evolution of the Blue-White Control deck. It features a pile of Planeswalkers, but with Oko in the mix. Sometimes you can add a taste of Astrolabes and Icefang Coattles. I think there's kind of like a spectrum going from 0 of them to a bunch of those cards. And then this finally becomes the furthest version of Bant Snow Control, features 4 of each of those. Part of the reason why I had success with it on Niv is because the mana base doesn't support Cryptic Command, and so they have a lot of Dovin's Vetoes and Force of Negations. There were multiple times each game where I felt super far behind, but I just cast a Niv and it resolved into like open mana and 4 cards in hand.
That feels good.
Yeah.
Yesterday, they had another banned and restricted announcement, as they do every Monday for Pioneer, and they announced no changes, and they have an inkling online that the weekly ban restricted announcement for Pioneer is going to go away, possibly at year's end. They didn't give any statements about sort of the health of the format, that they're monitoring anything. So it may be that they are now thinking that Pioneer is close to stable or close to what their vision of the format is. That's something to monitor going forward. We might be free of bans for a while until maybe the new set is printed.
I'm kind of concerned at the number of blue-green decks. You guys were saying you think that the Nexus of Fate builds are something to watch out for. And just by the numbers, this Simic Food Devotion deck was dominant in both the PTQ and the challenge.
Yeah, I mean, this is a concern I brought up when they were talking about banning Copter. I was like, if you just keep banning proactive cards, eventually you're going to ban stuff until Oko is the best thing you can do, and then it'll be everywhere. And then you're going to have to ban Oko. I don't particularly mind that, but I don't like the philosophy that leads to that happening. I can just say that Oko has not seemed like that overbearing of a card yet in Pioneer to me, weirdly. This list might have cracked it. The problem is still probably the fact that they have so many one-mana creatures The fact that they have, and I understand that people really care about this, but Llanowar Elves can't exist on whatever plane Elvish Mystic's on or whatever the hell happened. So we have eight cards like that. They didn't just print a Thoughtseize reprint that did 3 damage or something, so you could play 8 Thoughtseize. That random choice that they made where they aren't reprinting Opt and calling it something else on different planes has led to this weird state of Pioneer having 8 copies of the same card effectively for no reason. And it would feel really weird to ban like Elvish Mystic, but not Llanowar Elves, for instance. So I feel like fundamentally green is by far the most powerful color in the format, and it's not close. You saw Standard, they banned a bunch of cards from blue and green, and then blue-green was still the best deck in the tournament. And Eldraine is by far the most powerful set in Pioneer. So there's a lot of structural issues that are happening, and they've tried to balance it out as much as they can. I'm still not convinced that the blue-green deck is, like, too powerful. I need to see it over multiple weekends, and I think they've been a little too quick to some of these lists. Like, oh, this deck dominated for a weekend. Pioneer's card pool is not as deep as Modern's. There aren't as many answers, but there are changes people can make. And I wish, at least in this case, hopefully the deck is not so powerful that they feel like there's no possibilities for people. So I'd like to see how the metagame can adjust to it before we start talking about banning an additional card. But just for mental health reasons, I would love it if they banned Nexus of Fate. It's a miserable play experience. It's not an actual kill for sure, so you have to stick around and make sure that they actually have it. Everything about it is just bad in terms of like total enjoyment for both yourself and your opponent. Nexus should not be in the format.
I think it would be worse for the format if they banned one of the elves. I just remember when Llanowar Elf was legal in Standard, people complained about how insanely different the games played out when the green decks happened to have one of their elves on turn one. If you have 8 of them, at least people know that that's the play pattern to expect, elf into 3-drop. That kind of play pattern has never been a problem in any of Magic's formats over the years, until they started printing these push planeswalkers on 3, snowballing threats that don't have counterplay to them. I don't think it's fair to like point to elves and be like, well, these are the problem. And I think the format would be better if there was Inquisition in addition to Thoughtseize. The kind of redundancy of the staple effects makes for better gameplay, I find. You mentioned the Opt example. You know, it's kind of sad that there's not a second cantrip for 1 mana in blue. You can make a case against Thoughtscour, that'd be too strong with Delve or whatever. But it would be nice if there were a second one, so that you could do a little bit more with some of the cards that require a cantrip, like Thing in the Ice or Arclight Phoenix.
Yeah, I just don't think we're ever going to get Serum Visions even in Pioneer.
I think the fundamental issue with Pioneer is just there's so few sets that the actual color strength is wildly different. Green is by far the most powerful color, and black is the second most powerful color, specifically because of how it interacts with a bunch of the green cards. And then white basically has no good cards at all.
What are the top 5 white cards in Pioneer, David?
I tried to construct just the mono white, the top 5 mono white cards, and you do not hit a lot of cards before you name the card Thraben Inspector. That's a fun exercise for everybody at home. Get together with your buddies and just start listing them. You're going to get to cards like Knight of the White Orchid and Thraben Inspector before you get off of your first hand, and it's not going to feel good, man.
You're skipping the best white cards with that restriction. The best white card is probably Teferi 3. The second best is probably Teferi 5. Third best is probably Castle Ardenvale. And the fourth best is Azorius Charm. Supreme Verdict, Sphinx's Rev. There's a bunch of good Azorius cards, but yeah, not too many good straight white cards. I mean, Elspeth Sun Champion was a one of in the PTQ winning blue-white list.
Yeah, Elspeth, 4 mana Teferi.
Lyra Dawnbringer, also known as an elk.
The 1/1 that puts +1/+1 counters on all your humans, and then I think you'd have a hard time finding a mono-white card that's, other than those three, that's better than Thraben Inspector, and that is really sad. Thraben Inspector is way better than Lyra in this format, just so we're clear. It's not close. As Damon says, if you want to pay 5 mana for an elk, you are free to. Absolutely illegal play.
Yeah.
It will resolve. It's not going to get countered.
I do want to give a quick shout-out to one of my opponents from this Pioneer tournament that I was at. This is my 4th round opponent. He was playing blue-white Approach of the Second Sun. I mentioned that I was playing red-green Kiora, and the way that I built the deck was built for the grind. So I was really excited once I saw that he was on blue-white to just go toe-to-toe with card advantage. I even had Tireless Tracker's main deck. I had a bunch of adventure creatures. I had Kiora. I triggered Kiora every turn of the game, practically both games. But what I didn't expect was really clever choices in his build, where he wasn't using the Planeswalkers to win. He was using Approach of the Second Sun, both main deck and out of his Fae of Wishes wishboard, and it was actually extremely hard for me to kill him in time. He just kept staying alive. Cards that we don't like that much, like Declaration in Stone. But if all you're trying to do is stall towards Approach of the Second Sun, that's fine. And this happened multiple times. Every turn I would cast 3-4 spells and just be presenting what seemed like an overwhelming board, but he had just enough. He had a mix of Supreme Verdicts and Settler Wreckage to keep me guessing. I ended up walking into a settle with my Sark and the Masterless, because I didn't think he was going to have both. And the combination of Approach to the Second Sun with Search for Ascanta and Dig Through Time meant that as soon as he fired off the first one, the second one was always coming the next turn. I talked to him about it after the match, and he said he had initially tried some of these no-win condition Teferi blue-white decks and just couldn't keep up with what other decks were doing. And that was what I assumed was going to happen. Like, if he had been on a Teferi win condition, I would have obliterated him. He had no chance to answer all my permanents. But I just couldn't quite deal enough damage just by casting creatures and trying to attack with them. He had identified that as something that green decks were getting bigger and dumber, and that Approach really exploited that.
Yeah, the blue-white builds in Pioneer are pretty interesting. But Team Trio, I was putting my head down, was thinking through some lines against a Devoted Druid deck. And every time I would look over at my teammate, his opponent would have more and more Planeswalkers out. There are matchups where Supreme Verdict is an absolute all-star in Pioneer, but then there are matchups where you just have to like stop every single Planeswalker, and in a format where a lot of other people are playing little Teferi, it seems tricky to navigate that with blue-white, but somehow these several players are doing well in the challenges.
Anything else we want to say about Pioneer? Any other lists caught your eye?
No. Interesting to see if the format can adapt. Unfortunately, because the blue-green list is playing blue, I think the sideboard has something like 8 counterspells or something, so it's tough to go over the top of them in the way you're describing. Unlike red-green, they don't have to beat you down with Oko. They just have to present enough of a clock that they're multiple disdainful strokes, etc., just stall you long enough to win the game.
I have to say, I'm glad to see the Lotus Field combo deck is not putting up too good of results in the challenges. I think that deck is fun to have around, but it's kind of like Neobrand, where it's a little miserable to lose to it. It's just so hard to interact with that axis.
Yeah, it's like you get the joke now, and so it's not funny if they just keep telling it over and over again. You're like, no, man, I heard that.
Yeah.
There's really no counterplay other than specifically counter spells.
But Enter the Infinite is so cool every time. Yeah, I agree.
At least it is a deterministic kill, though. Like, once they cast their thing, you're like, all right, right-click, concede, good games. We both had fun.
Okay, we'll take a short break then. When we come back, we'll talk about how our testing results went with the Crested Sunmare.
Welcome back. We're here to revisit our card from last week, which is Crested Sunmare, a mythic rare out of Hour of Devastation. 3 white-white for a 5/5 horse, and it's a horse lord. It gives other horses that you control indestructible, and it has this not quite an ETB clause, but at the beginning of each end step, if you gained life this turn, create a 5/5 white horse creature token. So we brewed up a few lists for both Modern and Pioneer that are meant to capitalize on this card, featuring a bunch of ways to either find it quickly with cards like Eldritch Evolution, or just hard cast it and then gain life reliably with, like, for example, Cat Combo. First, we have a list that Dan modified coming out of GP Birmingham this summer. Dan, how did this list go?
I had a rough go of it. I took this list through a league, and as Damon mentioned, I did make a few updates. The most recent 5-0 list is a little bit out of date. It doesn't include any cards from Throne of Eldraine, which we know to be a broken set. So I thought, well, you know, why not give this a little bit of a tune-up? So I added Once Upon a Times to assist with getting the Mana Dork on turn 1. I also decided to put to the test this Gilded Goose theory. This is something of an old argument that in some ways has been decided against me, but in other ways, I was right the whole time. I'm just going to say that. To revisit, we were debating back in spoiler season whether you can just replace your Mana Dorks with Gilded Goose, or whether you could or you should. At a certain point, it became, well, actually, Gilded Goose is just an insane card for other reasons. You know, it does a lot of other stuff, especially in artifact decks. But in this deck, I'm not doing artifact stuff. I actually am just trying to ramp out some medium-sized green creatures. So I thought, what would happen if I replaced my Noble Hierarchs with Gilded Geese? I still have Birds of Paradise, and I have Once Upon a Time to find them, but the Gilded Goose having the ability to make food would, in theory, give me a little more horsepower. So it didn't really work out. So I played 5 rounds. I think my total horse count was 1. I made 1 horse token. It was kind of sad. And they got caught behind an ensnaring bridge the one time I got the ponies out to play. Bit of a rough go. Part of that was the matchups. It turns out that you just can't cast Eldritch Evolution when the opponent has counterspells in their deck. I got paired against a blue-red Cutthroat Kiki that liked to leave all its mana open on my turn. remand on Eldritch Evolution is, it feels pretty bad. Blue Tron, similar situation, you know, condescends, remands. Got paired against Mill. That was also a bit of a disaster. I did beat Burn quite decisively, as we thought would happen.
Ooh.
And then Bring to Light Saheeli, the five-color Bring to Light Saheeli deck, ended up losing that one as well. So it was a bit discouraging. I left the matches feeling like I was just playing with really, like, junior varsity cards against... It wasn't that I didn't have cards in my list to interact with what the opponents were doing, but when you're using cards in the green-white creature toolbox space to fight back against the opponent, you're not getting good rate on mana, you're not applying much of a clock. Whatever you do, it's just not going to kill them. You can make a play, destroy a permanent, and get some attacks in, but you haven't actually dealt lethal yet. So there's plenty of time for the opponent to regroup, execute their game plan, and go over the top of you on an access you weren't quite ready for. This Bring to Light Saheeli deck is a perfect example, where I won the die roll. It's a great start. I had a mana elf into a Kitchen Finx, and my opponent had led on a Utopia Sprawl into a Saheeli. I was able to Eldritch Evolution for an Acidic Slime to take out two of his mana sources, which... seems like I should be in great shape. I killed the Saheeli the next turn. Like, I was just crushing it. I had all these permanents against nothing on his side. And I still couldn't close the game. I got him down to two, and then he kiki-jiki killed me. So there's some structural issues here for this strategy, fundamentally, in Modern.
Yeah, Corsair of Kruphix just hasn't really ever gotten a lot of play in Modern in the last few years. Somehow, even if you account for the fact that it could help trigger Cress's Sunmare, maybe it just isn't a powerful enough card for what you could do at three mana in Modern.
I noticed this, again, could have been a matchup thing, that against most of these matchups, when I evaluated something like the Spike Feeder Archangel of Thuin Infinite Life combo that is built into the main deck here, that it wouldn't have actually won the game. The decks I was facing off against either had infinite combos of their own or something like a Karn or Ulamog to deck me. Extend that to the entire life game package as a whole, and you could start to see why Corsair of Kruphix, great against Burn, but pretty sad against these other decks.
Yeah, I imagine you'd want to be playing against Jund or Merfolk or maybe even Eldrazi Tron with this list, where these kind of grindy value green-white cards can shine.
Also, I mean, the Archangel infinite life combo is also infinite plus one counters on your creature. It's not like the old Project X list that are just trying to get infinite life and think that wins the game. I mean, you make an infinite power flying creature as well.
Yeah, that's true. I did leave the Archangel in. It was one of my only ways to close the game, but I had a tough time getting damage through. The other feeling that I was left with was that even when I wasn't being disrupted by the opponent, I was actually, you know, executing my plan. It kind of felt like, if you remember the old Duels of the Planeswalkers game, where there was like a training mode, when you're just learning Magic, you can get paired against an AI that just plays one Stormcrow every turn, or just plays one Grizzly Bear every turn. Maybe the first time you face off against that opponent, you can't figure out how to beat these Grizzly Bears. But as you improve at Magic, you learn to, like, stop chump blocking the Grizzly Bears and maybe put bigger cards in your deck that win combat against Grizzly Bears, and you defeat that and you level up to the next stage of the training game. And I kind of felt like I was playing that Grizzly Bear deck. Like, I was doing my thing, but Modern decks as a whole have trained themselves to defeat that kind of strategy. They're a little too advanced now for medium speed green-white creature beats.
So instead of every turn you get a Grizzly Bear, it's you get a turn 2 Corsair of Kruphix, turn 3 Tristani Selesnya's Voice, turn 4 Archangel of Thune. Can your Modern deck beat that start? If the answer is turn 3 Karn, the answer is probably yes. Or if it's Thoughtseize, Death Shadow, TBR, then I guess they probably could beat that kind of start pretty easily.
Yeah. I don't want to make too much out of one league, but it was tough. Also, just to follow up on the Gilded Goose thing, they were extremely punishing. I really regretted swapping out the Noble Hierarchs. I needed the mana, and I don't think I ever made a food. I ate some food, but I never made a food. So in this kind of deck, where you're not really getting any synergy besides the kind of loose win more synergy of have the Crested Sunmare down, and maybe I can make an extra 5/5 at some point, that never came up. Instead, I just really needed the mana to curve out properly with a mana dork like Hierarch that would tap every turn for mana.
Yeah, you also can rely on your Sapseep Forest to gain you life. I feel like you don't need the Goose for that source of inevitable life gain.
There it is.
As a quick reminder, Sapseep Forest is a forest subtype, so you can fetch it with your Windswept Heath. ETB tapped, but for a green tap, you gain a life if you control two or more green permanents. This is a way to reliably, in the late game, find a source of life gain if you have a Crested Sunmare that is just dying to get a little bit of life to get you a 5-5.
So is your takeaway, Dan, just generally, you know, Modern has always been a very powerful format, a very fast format, and with the introduction of Eldraine, it's only become more powerful. Basically, that as powerful as that set is, it did not add hardly anything to this list other than the four Once Upon a Times. So you think maybe just Sunmare is just not a Modern powered card. I mean, it seems like it's just a little below what you need to be doing at 5 mana.
I think that sums it up nicely. Attacking with creatures, this is not the way to do it. And Sunmare is fundamentally about attacking with creatures. So many decks in Modern aren't just going to blow through that with some other combo or something else.
Do you think a card that was just 3 white-white for a 5-5 ETB, you get another 5-5? Would that be like busted or also okay?
Well, first of all, that card would never make it through Standard, but in like the next Modern Horizons when they decide to pump and dump the format again?
Sure, yeah, MH2.
Think about the card Gigantosaur. 5 mana for 2 5-5s stapled together.
Well, think of the card Tulsimir. It's 5 mana for 2 3-3s plus some life gain. That card is not busted. You're saying that 5 mana for 2 5-5s would be busted?
No, I'm saying that you can get a 10-10 for 5, and it's not at all interesting.
Spread over 2 bodies is a lot better than Gigantosaur.
Oh, yeah, that's a huge difference.
3 white-white for 2 5-5s in Moderns actually does not seem good enough. If it was like white-green, maybe, is just to be a hit for Niv-Mizzet, would you ever play it? Probably not.
Yeah, your opponent would just be like, not the stupid 5-5 card. Trophy the main one, Teferi bounce the token. God damn it, this is such a pain, I have to use my Teferi. Yeah, I can see how that might not be good enough.
So much for Modern.
Yeah, on to Pioneer. We had 2 builds. We had an Orzhov horse list and an Abzan horse list. Dave, you want to walk us through those?
Yeah, I recommended this black-white list was my starting point. It featured, in addition to sort of the cat combo with the Sunmare, it also had Hidden Stockpile. My thought process was you just have all these random creatures in play. You know, you had 4 Thraben Inspector, one of the best white cards in the format. You have these cats, so if you don't have your oven, you at least are turning them into something, and you're just naturally sacking things. So you don't even have to do the scry ability of Hidden Stockpile. My thought was just collect all these 1/1s over the course of the game. The only league I played with that list, I went 0-4. Yeah, the list was just really frustrating. Part of it was just one of those leagues where, you know, you're flooded in one game and then you're hosed in the next and your opponent's top decking, you know, consecutive collected companies to beat you, etc. But the Hidden Stockpile engine felt very weak. I never liked that card even when it was in Standard. I know Dan and I were kind of chatting about when he took it to a GP and I didn't believe in it then. So I should have known better than to try to play it in a much more powerful format of Pioneer. The thought was that that card would kind of hold the fort. You wouldn't die, and then you eventually cast a Wrath, and then you cast your horse. But what happens is you just die. The 1/1s don't do anything, and you start having to, like, chump them off, not on your turn. And so you start running out of 1/1s, and there's so many cards, including Questing Beast and the 5/4 Elf. They can't actually be blocked by the 1/1s. They aren't even delaying the game at all. I mean, Questing Beast just literally reduces the card's text to nothing. So I need to do a rethink. And so what I want to do is play a different 2-mana engine on 2 that would kind of segue into the horse. What I wanted to play instead was Trail of Crumbs. So I kind of combined some of the cards from the white-green Eldritch Evolution list with the sort of black-white list. And the combination was to basically play the cat combo on the bottom still. Our engine is the Trail of Crumbs, so that works with the cat combo. And then the only white cards I was playing main were 2 Crested Sunmare that I would Eldritch Evolution for. So I still had like the Courser. We could still do the Goose into Courser. Turn 2, play a land, Eldritch Evolution, the Courser into the Sunmare and get a creature. And that list actually felt great. I went 4-1, and the only match I lost was timing out against a Fires of Invention Jeskai Planeswalker list that literally Wrath like 12 times or something over the course of each game. Each of those games went to 35 turns. But other than that, the list actually felt great. You have all this extra food for your Goose. You can ramp. You're playing proactively. And you kind of have this I win button against a bunch of the fair decks where all of a sudden you've traded all these resources and then you just turn your Courser or your Midnight Reaper, not Murderous Rider, or Murderous Rider, all of a sudden into a horse, and then you get a second horse, and then if they don't have something to deal with it on their turn, you get a third horse, and when the turns pass back to you, you're attacking with 15 power all of a sudden. Yeah, so the horse actually did feel quite powerful. The ability to turn it on, the turn it comes into play, as we had speculated, was really important. Every time I had to run it out naked as a 5-5, it felt really bad.
Were you using the evolution to get the horse, or were you just hard casting the horse?
I had enough white mana that I could reasonably cast the horse. I think there's like 5 or 6 sources plus 4 geese. But a lot of times when I was under pressure against aggro, I would just try to gain some life and then evolution in the horse, yeah. So like a tracker plus a land, you know, on the following turn, then turn into a horse. Courser, the Reaper, draw a card, get the horse, or eventually like, you know, EOT, kill their Oko, play the Murderous Rider, attack into nothing. They choose not to block because they think they're going to get you on the back end, turn that into a horse. It comes up a lot. Sometimes you just can't attack. Just proactively sacking it, making sure you leave your cat interaction with food in play to happen on your turn. And if you have a way to do it the turn and then the next turn, if they don't specifically have Oko or their own Murderous Rider, there aren't actually that many main deck ways to kill the horse. The horse itself felt like a reasonable win condition in a lot of these mid-range matchups. Because the blue-green decks are all over the place and they don't basically play removal at all, it's too big for a Wicked Wolf to kill. And they only have four Okos. Oko making it a 3-3 after you get a 5-5, then you get to attack it with 8 power, is a reasonable trade, considering you're interacting with the most powerful card in the format, possibly.
Yeah, although I have to say that typically the Crescent Sunmare, by the time it comes out against these Oko decks, they have just too much clutter going on. They just make your Sunmare an elk, and they have, meanwhile, like a Lovestruck Beast or whatever to trade with the 5-5. I had this problem. I played this deck a couple times and had problems with my Eldritch Evolution resolving. But one thing I want to mention is this deck actually has, at this point, a Mythic Championship pedigree. A lot of these cards, Cauldron Familiar, plus Witch's Oven, plus Trail of Crumbs, along with Gilded Goose and Murderous Rider, are fresh off of Canister's win at Mythic Championship 7 of this year. I guess the difference here is that instead of getting to play stupid Korvald, we get to have a huge upgrade with Crest of Sunmare at the 5-drop slot.
So real talk, is it an upgrade over Korvald, or is it just worse than Korvald? They both cost 5.
That's a great question, Dan. It's true. Did you guys watch any of the Mythic Championship?
Some. I caught some of it, yeah.
I had to turn it off after a few minutes, so.
Did you guys catch any Korvald turns in the Mythic Championship?
I saw one at the previous Mythic Championship where it looked kind of cool. It's a card that Dan and I had actually kicked around as a possible modern with some of the sac effects. But yeah, it seems super powerful in some of the mid-range mirrors that seem to dominate standard these days.
Yeah, it's one of those cards. It looked like if you untap with it, you win the game. You just draw so many cards every turn. And even the turn you play it, you can frequently have like a Fabled Passage lying around or a Cat Oven combo and get several cards drawn. So I was actually quite impressed with Korvald, and I actually would wonder if you just took this Absent Horse list and kind of mutated it to more of a Jund Sacrifice list, how it would do.
I mean, it's possible. We've joked about it, but it's like very real. I mean, Eldraine is so much more powerful than a set like Amonkhet.
Yeah.
You almost shouldn't consider any mythic cards from Amonkhet as playable unless you've exhausted like every Eldraine option first. And white, again, is the worst color. I'm not playing any white cards at all in my main deck because none of them are good. So yeah, it's a very reasonable question. The one thing is, not that this necessarily matters, Korvald might still be better, but Pioneer is very tempo-oriented, especially because of this one-drop elf feature if you're Dan or bug if you're me. A lot of times, a 5-5 on board is better than drawing like one or two cards because two 5-5s really does stabilize the board against a lot of these mid-range decks, whereas getting one Korvald that draws, you know, let's say three cards, the interaction with the board, if they just have one way to kill it, now all of a sudden you have no blockers, whereas if they just kill your horse, you at least are left with a 5-5, and that actually shuts down most attacking creatures.
Yeah, the standard Jund Sacrifice build is not just for Korvald, but also for Mayhem Devil, so that every time you sacrifice something, you have a little bit of board control going on. It's probably not a good idea to just make our entire win condition two Korvalds. You should have a little more of a plan than that. But two horses, it seemed like it was working for you pretty effectively.
Yeah, I was actually pleasantly surprised. There are a bunch of times where you just cast it, trigger it, and then at the end of their turn, they would throw down. If they don't specifically have Murderous Rider or Oko, there aren't that many other cards that actually do anything against it.
What were your matchups in the 4-1 league?
I played blue-green monsters. I played Jerry's deck, although not someone as good as Jerry, I will say. There were some interesting choices made. So yeah, blue-green monsters, blue-green devotion, black-green mid-range, and blue-white spirits. And then I lost to Jeskai Planeswalkers. Through timeout. I was way ahead in game 3, could not lose. Blight Beetle being the MVP out of the sideboard is key to beating the blue-green devotion list.
Yeah, Dave was raving about this card in our group hangout. I have to say, I tried it against the blue-green deck, and I was impressed. It seems to just completely block their entire team. Makes Jade Light Ranger kind of suck. It makes Hydroid Crisis suck. It makes Scavenging Ooze not able to grow. It makes Wicked Wolf not able to grow. And meanwhile, it can chump block these creatures indefinitely.
And their way to kill it normally would be Walking Ballista, which they can't even cast anymore. Black is really important because it gives you proactive ways to kill Oko. You can play Abrupt Decay or Noxious Grasp, And Noxious Grasp actually giving you life matters, so it gives you another way to gain life on your opponent's turn.
It was made for this sideboard.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, at this point, I would highly recommend playing black if you can, because it's one of the only counters to green. And unlike green, the super powerful sideboard hoser that was printed recently has not been banned. So
yeah, and there's this card, Lifebane Zombie, that actually would be a nice Eldritch Evolution target, because it comes in, it rips a green creature out of their hand, and then happily dies to become a horse.
That card was great in standard. So Damon, you tried the Abzan build.
Yeah, I've been a little bit busy testing for GP Portland, which is standard, so I didn't have time to play a full league. I got two matches in and did not do very well. I played against Blue-Green Nexus, and they just went over the top of anything, and it didn't really seem to matter what I did. I had a sweet curve where I had like turn one Gilded Goose, turn two Murderous Rider into turn three Elder's Evolution, and they had Aether Gust. And then my hand was out of gas, and I just died. Then next I played against the Green-Blue Devotion list, and I managed to win game two off the back of Blight Beetle. It was quite impressive. Game three was sad. I assembled this army of three ovens and three faithful cats and a Midnight Reaper at some point. And then they had an Oko, and my Midnight Reaper became an elk. But the cats kept chewing down their life total, and then they started making all this food, because Nykthos plus two geese is just a lot of mana to make food every turn. I was like, all right, clawed through the first depot worth of food. They're running low again. And then they just played like Hydroid Crisis for X equals 16, and Blight Beetle, even though he stopped half of it, it wasn't quite enough.
This seemed to be a trend in some of the matches that it seemed like the horse deck was struggling with, was other decks just going over the top. I saw this coming up. I think, Dave, you tried the black-white build one more time. I saw you facing another Planeswalker deck where it seemed like the long game.
Same guy that timed me out, by the way. Shout out to that guy.
Oh, no.
He's been a good opponent. I hate his deck, but tip of the cap to him for some interesting lines. I don't know if they're right or wrong because his deck is so unintuitive to me, but it's basically just like 30 Planeswalkers, 4 Fires of Invention, 4 Fae of Wishes, and 30 Wraths.
Oh, Jeskai Super Friends.
Yeah, but he was also playing like the 7-mana Nicol Bolas Planeswalker, and then he was playing the Oath of Teferi, so he just like 14 me.
Wow.
Out of nowhere, so I was like, oh, I might go to time again. He's like, nah, 14 to you, my friend. That'll do. That specific list is tough, and again, like this list has a ton of ways to kill Planeswalkers between Murderous Rider, the Noxious Grasp. I think the sideboard had like a one of Anguished Unmaking. If you don't draw specifically those cards, even the card advantage engines start to kind of fall behind some of these super Planeswalker builds. I don't think that list is something you need to really concern yourself with. In every other matchup, the blue-green Stompy, the Sultai Food matchup, and I played like a Vanifer combo list. Those are all just easy 2-0s. I think this one guy, Jersey 251 or whatever, just has my number. He just knows I hate Planeswalkers. His list is literally just all Planeswalkers. I hope to never run into him in the queues.
Apart from that matchup in particular, would you two agree that the deck has a trouble with other decks that can go over the top? You mentioned this giant Hydroid Crisis or a Nexus of Fate endgame. I don't see how this horse deck can apply enough pressure and disruption to stop an opponent from assembling their engine and going bigger.
Yeah, you need to draw a very specific number of cards. I think that problem is endemic to basically any black-white list. Sure, you have Thoughtseize, but you don't present the clock that a deck like Mono Black does. You don't have any like 2-mana 3-power creatures. So you can disrupt them, you can delay them, but your sideboard is really focused around destroying Planeswalkers. So if they're casting spells like Nexus of Fate, if they're casting spells like Pour Through the Pages, yeah, you're not going to be able to beat them.
Yeah, I mean, the deck is really structured with a sufficiently slow clock that it can't really pretend to be an aggro deck, which means that it has to either be a mid-range deck, I guess, or a combo deck or a control deck. It's clearly not a combo deck. And so does it have to play a controlling role in a lot of these matchups? And the answer is yes, because right around turn 5 or turn 6, like, you can guarantee that any opposing deck is going to do something bad for you. Can't really mid-range your way through that. Cressus Sunmare, like, is not the type of thing where, you know, they do something big and you're like, haha, I get 2-5-5. This is even bigger than your big thing. It probably isn't. Then you're left trying to stop any deck with a combination of a few Thoughtseize, a few Murderous Riders, and a Cat Oven combo, which doesn't feel like enough to me.
I actually have found Pioneer to be kind of a tempo-y mid-range battle, and in all those matchups, this deck actually feels pretty well positioned. I was actually surprised by how comfortable all those matchups felt. The outlier matchups are these weirdo all-Planeswalker lists, the Nexus of Fate deck that I hope is banned at some point, And if you play the Lotus list, I can't imagine you even have a chance against it. But I actually felt reasonably well matched against some of the like the blue-green food lists. Just because your sideboard is so tuned to it, they probably don't have almost no cards they want to bring in against you. They're concerned about other matchups. So after board, it feels like your matchup really improves. I don't know how much, but...
Yeah, I mean, I certainly have 3 more games in this league to see how things go. It's possible I'm underestimating the power of this deck in those sorts of matchups.
We'll check back with Damon's 3-2 report next week.
But I will say this. I think the key thing to understand is that Pioneer, even though it is very tempo-focused, you're going to get to turn 5 or 6 every game. So whereas in Modern, Dan never had time, or basically never had time, to activate his Goose. That's a very common thing to be doing. I did it in every game I played with the Abzan list. You've got time to activate Trail of Crumbs, start assembling a bunch of permanents to gain extra life with Horse in play. Your opponent's not going to assemble 2 cards that just kill you. All these incremental steps of value are actually a thing, and you can just turn the corner on some of these lists that seem like they're ahead of you with their, you know, turn 1, turn 2 Oko. If it just makes a food or a 3-3 and you kill it, you end up outsizing that stuff pretty quickly.
So where do we stand now on the Horse, the Crested Summoner? What's our final thoughts, our summary?
I was not impressed.
I was surprised that it seemed borderline playable. I think the fact that it's white is actually like the biggest negative. You have to play in a color that doesn't have any other cards to support it. If it was a black card or a green card, I think it would see a ton more play, but it's not. Its power level is just at the level that's acceptable to not be embarrassed to play a 5-drop in this format. So going out of your way to do all this extra stuff when you could just play Nissa does not seem worth it.
The other thing that has given me some reservations about the card is that it didn't feel like the life gain that is necessary to turn on the Crested Summoner was ever that well positioned, either in Modern or Pioneer. Like, we picked out cards that were plausible and happened to gain life, whether that's the Cat combo or Scavenging Ooze or Corsair Crucifix. But these were not life gain decks. They weren't decks that were like really happy to draw these life gain cards and getting paid off every time. It was kind of like we were just choosing from a pretty narrow selection of cards that happened to gain life and were sort of playable otherwise. But only the Sunmare was really capitalizing on that life gain. So I kind of wonder if there's another build out there that is maybe like really all in on life gain.
The meta in Pioneer doesn't feel like life gain is necessarily all that important against most decks besides mono red. And even mono red features like Hazoret type cards to go way over the top of life gain and deal lots of damage in fairly big chunks. And so I wonder if the meta we live in now, gaining life against like a Bant Coco deck or just Azorius Control, like there's a lot of decks where it doesn't really do anything for your survivability.
Well, that's what I was getting at, where it felt like we weren't getting rewarded that much for choosing cards that happen to gain life. But what if there's a build that actually is like really life gain synergy, like a Johnny's Pride Mate type stuff or a Lone Rider that we talked about last week? You know, you're playing the life gain for your own purposes and like maybe really specialized life gain cards.
I completely agree with your point, Dan. I'm just wondering if it's better to actually say that, well, maybe this fundamental idea would be better in a meta where life gain is better suited. And the Pioneer of today maybe is not in that position, but the Pioneer of tomorrow or some number of months from now. You know, like Modern has had times where all you play against in the queues are Red Prowess builds over and over, just Boros Burn, etc. Right now, you don't see too much of it.
I crushed my Burn opponent. Yeah, you could bank that win. Easy 2-0.
Yeah, I wish Pioneer Burn was a little bit better somehow so that it could have a non-zero meta presence.
Yeah, they just need to print a better one mana burn spell. It doesn't have to be Lightning Bolt, but it needs to be better than Wild Slash. Just to answer your point, I didn't feel like I was bending over backwards to play cards with life gain in them. The Cat combo, I was intentionally playing with other cards. So I was playing 3 Midnight Reaper in the white blacklist. Upgrading the enchantment to that was very important to generate this. You know, I know it's a card that Damon's been saying we really should consider this if Dave's going to keep jamming this Cat combo in. And yeah, it's great. It turns your interaction that you're playing into tons of cards. And then in the other list, that's why you play Trail of Crumbs as well. You're not asking the life gain to pay you off. It's this sacrifice effect that you're turning into, hopefully, a bunch of extra material. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about our new card of the week, which is Fires of Invention. Welcome back. So as previously mentioned, our card of the week is Fires of Invention. This is yet another powerful card from the Eldraine set. Fires of Invention is 3 and a red for an enchantment. It reads, you can cast spells only during your turn, and you can cast no more than two spells each turn. You may cast spells with converted mana costs less than or equal to the number of lands you control without paying their mana costs. So some important things to understand about this are that the can't cast trumps all other spell permissions. You may cast without paying mana, but you can still pay mana if you like, if that's giving you some kind of extra benefit. You can pay additional costs if you like. X must be zero if you're using the without paying mode. Alternative costs must be paid with mana, so like flashback. And it retroactively checks the spells cast for the entire turn. So the turn you cast it, for instance, it already knows that that was a spell. So you can only cast one more spell that turn. So, Damon, just to kind of start us off, can you talk a little bit about how this card is being used in Standard?
Yeah, this card has been seeing a lot of play in what's called the Jeskai Fires list in Standard, which I've been staying up to date with just because we have this GP coming up. Jeskai Fires has seen a few evolutions. The first one is based around kind of like the Super Friends style, where you have like Sarkins and Teferis and Narsets and all those sorts of cards. What's really taken shape recently that has put the deck at maybe perhaps public enemy number one in the Standard meta, a true tier one deck, is a build that's built around the Cavaliers from M20, Cavalier of Flame and Cavalier of Gales. These are 5 mana for big, big beaters. Cavalier of Flame is 2 red, red, red for a 6/5 with an ETB that lets you discard any number of cards from your hand and draw that number of cards. And then it has this activated ability, 1 in a red, creatures you control get +1/+0 and gain haste until end of turn. We'll come back to that ability in a second. And it even has a more text on it, Questing Beast style, but let's ignore that because it's kind of boring. Cavalier of Gales is 2 blue, blue, blue for a 5/5 flyer. ETB, you brainstorm, and then when it dies, you shuffle it back in and scry 2. Not cards you typically would see in Standard, but Fires really lets you cheat with them, because the way this deck really wants to function is maybe curve out with turn 2 Shimmer of Possibility, which is basically an impulse. It looks 4 deep and you pick 1. Find your Fires of Invention, turn 3 Teferi Time Raveler so your opponent can't mess with you, turn 4 Fires of Invention, and then the cool thing about Fires is it fundamentally costs 0 mana, because the turn you cast it, you effectively can play another spell for free. And so on turn 4, you can play both Fires and, for example, Sphinx of Foresight. So you get this 4/4 flyer. And then here's where things go nutty. On turn 5, you play Cavalier of Flame and Cavalier of Gales in the same turn for 0 mana with Fires. You have 5 lands in play, so you can activate Cavalier twice, which gives your whole team of Cavalier of Flame, Cavalier of Gales, and Sphinx of Foresight +2/+0 in haste. And now you're attacking for 6+8+7 is lethal, which is pretty crazy. The deck also features cards like Kenrith, which similarly cheat on mana with Fires, or in particular take advantage of the fact that with Fires you have all your mana up. What this deck is trying to do post-Fires is play a Kenrith, which can let you gain a lot of life and draw cards, or Cavalier of Flame lets you dump your mana. Or the coolest thing in this deck, honestly, is the Castle Vantress it plays. Nothing lets you scry 2 more aggressively than knowing you don't need to use mana to cast spells. And so every upkeep you can scry 2 means that this deck basically never really runs out of gas. It's very rare that this deck takes a turn off when you're playing against it if they have an active Fires in play. So this deck really is a nice home for Fires of Invention, and it's a very strong Standard deck.
If we're going to extrapolate from the Standard deck that you're describing, again, one of the big decks at the Mythic Championship over the weekend, what is the card Fires of Invention actually doing for that deck? Like, you don't need a Fires to cast a Cavalier. What makes this a Fires deck, or what are the lessons from it that we can extrapolate to other formats?
Playing one Cavalier a turn, just off mana, is fine, but not really good enough. If your opponent untaps and goes nuts with Korvold, or you're playing against a deck featuring like Brazen Borrowers and Quenches, you're going to get out-tempoed or possibly just have your one spell a turn countered. At the point that you can go 2 spells in a turn for free, it's much harder to keep up with this deck. That really lets it push through and is a much more sort of broken thing to do on turn 5 is to play 2 Cavaliers and give them both haste. This will put most other decks on the back foot. They really have to think about defense for the turn after that. And if they kill your Cavalier of Gales, you get a scry 2 and try to find even more gas. And then it capitalizes with the mana advantage so strongly with these activated abilities. Like, compare a turn where you tap 5 lands and play Cavalier of Flame to a turn where you play Cavalier of Flame for free, play Cavalier of Gales for free, and then scry 2 off Castle Vantress so that next turn you can go Cavalier of Gales, brainstorm, find a Cavalier of Flame because you scry those both to the top, and then it's just hard to lose that game.
What I really like about the deck that you're describing is that if we started with the card Fires of Invention by itself and we didn't know there was a successful build of the deck, we just try to think through what is the card actually doing for you and how would you build a deck to take advantage of it. What you come up with is that it's this huge mana engine. It allows you to effectively triple your mana It counts the number of lands you have, and then it lets you cast two spells that would use up to that many lands, right? So you're saying on turn five, if you have five lands and a flyer, you get to cast 2 5 drops. That's amazing. And somehow your lands are still on tap, so you can triple your mana by having something to do with the land. I want a deck that had a lot of activated abilities on permanence so that I'm not just wasting my mana. I'm casting two spells for free with the flyers, but then I still have these untapped lands that I put towards something. It sounds like this standard build checks all the boxes, creatures that have activated abilities, or the land like Castle Ventress that has activated abilities. And I think fundamentally it just gets to this issue of double spelling in Magic. The person who's ahead is often the first person to double spell. That's also true in Modern in some sense, why Modern emphasizes efficient spells so much. If you can do two things on a turn where your opponent is just trying to do one thing, and we're imagining that most cards are good enough that they trade for each other, the person who's doing two things in a turn is going to come out ahead of the person who is only doing one thing in a turn. Fire is kind of really codifies that, and it says, hey, you can do two things a turn. There you go. You have lands, you get two things. And if you can think cleverly about how to get activated abilities into your deck, you can do more than two things, which I think some of these Kenrith, Castle Ventress cards are doing really effectively.
Yeah, and I think we learned some lessons from this deck also in that like it's okay to play counterspells in your Fires of Invention deck, even though it has this clause that you can't cast spells during your opponent's turn. If you can have such a strong engine when Fires is in play, you can afford to play a few pieces that don't work at all when it's in play to help you survive to that point. Another thing that I noticed from this deck is, for example, I think the card Opt is not what you want in your Fire Shell. If you're going to play cantrips, they have to like actually be good cantrips, because you can't really be afforded to casting Opt with Fires in play into more cantrips. It takes up your entire turn to do that.
So high impact spells, basically, is what we're looking for.
Right, right. So when it comes to brewing with this card, the format we want to first look at is Modern. Dan, what are your thoughts on using this card there?
So I always like to start by checking to see what people have done with the card in Modern. Fires of Invention is a card that some of our listeners have been pestering us about for a while and say, hey, this card is sweet. And I think there's a lot of interest in it in Modern when Eldraine was being previewed. Rightfully so, because tripling your mana is pretty insane if you can pull that off. It's like a Wilderness Reclamation. It's like having two Wilderness Reclamations in play at the same time. But in the Modern card pool, there's a weird interaction with the line of text that says you may cast spells without paying their mana costs. We're familiar in Modern with the card As Foretold that lets you cast something without paying its mana costs. That will let you cast the free spells, these Time Spiral Suspend cards, Ancestral Vision, Restore Balance, Living End, and now Crashing Footfalls from Modern Horizons. Fires of Invention having that line of text means that it does function as an additional copy of As Foretold if you are trying to build a deck exploiting that rules interaction. And there have indeed been a couple of 5-0s with decks built on that concept. They're basically As Foretold decks, but they also play 2 or 3 copies of Fires of Invention on top of that to really get redundancy on the effect. We had a week on Crashing Footfalls, week 10, 11 or something like that. I think we found that As Foretold was the best card in that deck. You know, there are other ways to enable like Electrodominance or whatever. They're not so good. If I had the choice of just playing like 6 As Foretolds, that would be an effective way to do it. The other place where we've seen some results with Fires of Invention in Modern is in the Taking Turns shell. Taking Turns is a deck that is mostly blue, maybe with light splashes for lightning bolts, that kind of thing. Fires of Invention being a single red pip means that you can easily splash it into a deck like this. What it unlocks within the Turns shell is a very peculiar card called Savor the Moment. Are you guys familiar with this one?
Very familiar. I think when this card was spoiled and we were trying to figure out what to do with this, I was like, man, Savor the Moment. I'm always trying to play that card. And you're always like, this card sucks. Why do you keep talking about it? And here we are, finally away. An excuse to play this sweet 3-mana Time Walk.
I mean, it does kind of suck, right? It's like,
oh yeah, it's bad.
It's one blue sorcery. Take an extra turn after this one. Skip the untap step of that turn. So you get a 2-mana discount on your Time Warp, but in exchange, you're probably not going to do anything on the extra turn because you're like tapped out. You're just going to draw a card and pass. That's how it used to be. But now with Fires, that doesn't actually matter. You're not really using your mana for casting spells. Your mana is just sort of hanging out. What I liked about these builds, though there was a couple 5-0s, I think the first one came from LSV, is that they found ways to incorporate some of these mana sinks that we talked about. Turns always like to play one copy of Mikakoro, Center of the Sea, which taps to draw a card, and then two Castle of Entress, which lets you pour your mana into scrying towards your next extra turn spells. In addition to that, the turn shell also gets to take advantage of Mystic Sanctuary. Looping extra turn spells when you have a Dictator Crucifix or Howling Mine in play is a pretty easy way to make this a deterministic kill. So that's what we've seen so far from Modern. Basically trying to break the card, right? Either the free spell, the zero mana spell aspect, or the don't have to tap your lands aspect. What we haven't seen so far, where I think there's still unexplored space, is a slightly more fair use of the card as just a big mana engine. And here I would be inspired primarily by the standard build where, like Damon was saying, the standard builds of like Jeskai Fires incorporate all these cards with activated abilities so that you get to like cast two big things in a turn and then also pour your lands into some other effect. And I was going through the Modern card pool and thinking, like, you know, there's plenty of stuff in Modern that you could play that has activated abilities. Some of them are not that efficient, like Walking Ballista, paying four, get a counter, that's not that exciting. But let's say I had a Tireless Tracker with a big pile of clues, like that's a little more interesting. If you had unlimited mana, like sure, Tireless Tracker becomes a great card. Cassic Wolf Run is another one that, you know, when we play Red-Green Kiora, I'm always happy to draw the Wolf Run. Digging through the Modern card pool for things with activated abilities could end up at a really interesting big mana Fires deck. So the shell that I'm proposing is Red-Green, essentially based around the idea of making your land drops. So Fires of Invention does require actual land drops. You can't just play your Mana Elf, Utopia Sprawl, Arbor Elf, that kind of thing. You need to make actual land drops. I want to accelerate land drops, and then I want to just explode the turn that I get a Fires of Invention in play by pouring all my extra mana into like a big card draw spell. So I have a full set of Tireless Trackers here with a bunch of fetch lands, and I have a full set of Escape to the Wilds from Eldraine. All the best cards come from Throne of Eldraine. 3 green-red sorcery, exile the top 5 cards of your library. You may play cards exiled this way until the end of your next turn, and you may play an additional land this turn. So it's kind of like a turbocharged explorer. You get an extra land drop, but you don't draw one, you draw like 5.
Yeah, this card is some of the best card advantage that red and green get these days. There's like a term for it, it's like an impulsive draw or something.
Yeah, this gives you the same window that Light Up the Stage gives you. It can be this turn and next turn, so you can potentially get, let's say you hit 2 lands, 3 spells, you can play both those lands, and you can cast the spells. It's a little bit awkward in conjunction with Fires of Invention, in the sense that Fires restricts you to casting 2 spells a turn. Let's say Escape to the Wilds is your first spell on 5 mana. You get to play 1 more spell that turn, and then 2 more the next turn. The other cards that I have to sort of round out the build, I have some adventure creatures, which do a good job of giving me stuff to do to make use of all this extra mana that I'm going to have. So I have both the Bonecrusher Giant, which has been a favorite in basically every format for us so far. It's been fantastic. Love this card. And Beanstalk Giant. The adventure mode on Beanstalk Giant is 2 and a green for Fertile Footsteps. Search your library for a basic land, put it onto the battlefield untapped, and then shuffle your library. Then for 7 mana, you get a star-star creature whose power and toughness is equal to the number of lands you control. So what I'm envisioning this deck doing is just making a ton of land drops and drawing a ton of cards. At some point, you kill them. That can be with Field of the Dead, it can be with Tireless Trackers, or just casting a Beanstalk Giant. Or getting a big Keswick Wolf Run, pouring all your mana into that. What do you guys think of this concept?
The card I really like in this is the Escape to the Wilds. I think that one of the things to really capitalize on Fires of Invention is that you fundamentally go down a card when you cast Fires. As a result, like you have to basically have a couple high-impact plays after it to really make it shine. So, for example, if you only have one kind of 5-mana beater, you're not really getting anything out of your Fires. This is where the standard deck really seems to set a good template. They have around 8 or so big cards to play. The 4 Cavalier of Flame, 3 Cavalier of Gales, 2 Kenrith, and then they even have these Sinks of Foresight, which at a 4-4 in standard is actually kind of a fine card to play. And so my concern with the Fires in this list as described is that you don't quite have enough beefy 5-6 mana plays to make. The one card I see here that I like is the Scargan Hellkite, because it comes in and can immediately start using its ability to shoot 2 mana damages. And so if you go Fires into Escape and then you flip over a Tracker, it's good. But the problem is that if you get Tracker and you have a bunch of mana to go drawing a bunch of cards with your Fetchland base, and you draw 10 cards, and these cards are cards like more Trackers and Bone Crushers and Sakura Tribe Scouts, you can't really deploy them effectively because you have a Fires of Invention in play. Bone Crusher Giant takes up your entire turn to use both halves of it. That's perhaps fine in the right situation, but if you have a Fires and all these cards in hand, that's really not as big as you'd want to be going.
So you're thinking that a deck should have bigger impact cards, be a little greedier, go higher up the curve.
Right. I think you need more big mana 5 or 6 drops.
A sister point to that, although maybe Damon won't necessarily agree with my diagnosis. I don't like Once Upon a Time with the Fires. I'm sure it's there to make sure you get your guy on turn one or late in the game to find your big beater. But because it's one of the spells already, I think it's just not powerful enough. So I don't like it, kind of for the same reason that we were saying we didn't love Opt in the lists. You're already playing 27 lands, so your deck's starting to have a lot of air in it. And then another 4 of that you're playing is Escape to the Wilds. You're starting to play a lot of cards that don't actually do anything, that are trying to accrue extra advantage, and you need something that's going to pay you off for all that at the end of it.
The theory behind Once Upon a Time is that this is a Field of the Dead endgame, the way that I've drawn it up. When you're trying to make land drops, Arboreal Grazer is significantly better than the other options. But I don't want to play a million Arboreal Grazers. I want a card that can be my 6th or 7th Arboreal Grazer, but can also become my Tireless Tracker if I need it to be, or my Scargon Hellguide if I need it to be that. So that was the idea behind Once Upon a Time. What you're saying about once the Fires is online, this becomes kind of just a block. It just gets in the way of trying to actually impact the board. That could be something that once I start playing the games, I'll realize I shouldn't be including that Once Upon a Time. So it's certainly possible to play more 5-drops. I think my original inspiration for this list, one of our listeners, the chemistry guy, Jason, had been playing Fires of Invention in his build of Red-Green Kiora and had been suggesting to me that actually just putting Fires in that deck in small numbers is fantastic. If you're willing to make concessions, Beanstalk Giant or Arboreal Grazer on a higher land count. So that really made me wonder. Now, I trimmed the Glorybringer package, and maybe that's a mistake. Maybe I need to go back to that instead of leaning so hard on Escape to the Wilds to make more land drops. Maybe I should be playing cards like the Red Cavalier or like Glorybringer that will take care of whatever the board situation is, not worry so much about ramping.
Yeah, this is where I think the deck building kind of takes two forks. One is where you build a deck that wants to rely on finding Fires every game and is really not meant to function that well without Fires. Or you build a deck that doesn't rely on Fires and has a very strong normal game plan that occasionally becomes extremely strong with Fires. It's not clear to me that Green Red has the tools to find Fires reliably enough. So, for example, the Jeskai Fires deck in Standard plays a number of Shimmer of Possibilities along with Temples, along with Sphinx of Foresight, which are all digging you very deep towards Fires. Green Red, maybe Escape to the Wilds actually can dig, it digs 5 cards. That's a lot.
I agree, and I'm actually only playing 3 Fires because, like you're saying, I can't count on having it every game, especially not with the total lack of selection that's in this configuration. Now, that being said, the mana bases in Modern are more forgiving. It doesn't have to be a straight red-green deck. If we decide that it's important to find the Fires more often, I think something like Sphinx of Foresight is actually a really brilliant inclusion. The way that those two work together is just so beautiful, because Sphinx of Foresight, so great in your opening hand, but the trade-off is that it's almost dead beyond that. You never want to tap 4 lands for a Sphinx. Well, okay, if you're just getting a free 4/4 at some point, that's actually pretty good. So I could see a build that was maybe going back toward the Sphinx as a way to really count on having the Fires more often.
Yeah, I wonder about playing the Red Cavalier in this list, because Arboreal Grazer can actually get in the red zone.
Yeah, not a wall, not a defender.
the Cavalier finish that's so explosive out of the Jeskai Fire Standard list, I think is a pretty important part of that deck, where it turns the corner really fast the turn after Fires resolves. And so I wonder if having access to that in this deck would be important. I noticed you went with this kind of heavy red and 6 lands package with 4 Field of the Dead and then Thickets That Cycle.
Yes.
Do you think that the Ren and 6 plan is compared to a Kiora plan featuring a bunch of 5-drop dragons, here I wonder that, Fires of Invention into Ren and 6 doesn't seem like a great play to me.
No, the Ren and 6 is meant to support your Arboreal Grazers and your Sakura Tribe Scouts. Those cards so far have only been really worth it in Modern if you're playing Bounce Lands and Amulet Titan. Bounce Lands give you a steady stream of lands to play, and if I'm not filling my deck with Bounce Lands, which I think Fires of Invention doesn't work that well with them, I need some way to make sure I have land drops to make. A package just built around getting extra land plays with, Arboreal Grazer, Sakura Tribe Scout, I have a Wayward Swordtooth in there, and then the Escape to the Wilds also gives you extra land plays. You actually need to have lands to make the land drops, and Ren and 6 is there to support that angle. So I have 4 card draw spells. I have Tireless Tracker, Renin 6, and Escape to the Wilds. But some of the cards I draw are going to be lands because I'm expecting to kill with Field of the Dead or Kessig Wolf Run or even Raging Ravines.
Just again, to sort of support what Damon was saying, I think if your Field of the Dead kill is part of how you're trying to win, I actually really, again, like the Red Cavalier. Skargon Hellkite is fine, but 4 mana do 2 damage. I mean, the sizing of creatures in Modern, I mean, what is that killing on turn 5? Whereas the Cavalier buffing multiple zombies turns that clock from Field of the Dead into a very fast one. You could get 2 or 3 zombies that turn, give them all haste and +2/+0 or something, and all of a sudden you're killing them out of nowhere. So I really like that as a top end. And because, like you said, the mana is so forgiving, you've got a lot of red sources. Because the trigger for Field of the Dead is basically free. Like on your turn, you play a land and a fetch land. And if you have 2 fields, you get 4 zombies. Even without the enchantment in play, if you already have a Cavalier in play, you can still activate it. And that becomes a very threatening board. So I think the ability to sort of just steal, I mean, what is that? 4 zombies plus 2 activations. That's a lot of damage out of nowhere. I've just never been a believer in Skargon Hellkite. The 4 mana to do 2 damage is just, I'm over it. You could strap that ability on almost any creature and it doesn't make it more playable to me.
Skargon Hellkite is somehow better than it looks. That's all I have to say on that one. Dan, I think the biggest thing with this list is that I'm not sure that marrying the kind of like red-green lands package with Fires of Invention is really that important. If you're hitting every land drop through turn 7 along with ramp spells along the way, I'm not sure you really need to have like extra mana advantage. Really, you kind of want to like guarantee you hit your 4th and 5th land drop, but after that, you don't really need more land drops with Fires of Invention. It doesn't really reward you going past that unless you are building your deck with a bunch of like really expensive cards. So you're spending all this deck space on the Renin 6s and the Grazers, and compare that to like the standard list, which just uses that space for boom booms, for lack of a better word.
But the standard list can afford to do nothing for the first 4 turns, and I think if you watch the Mythic Championship, that was very clear that nothing happens in the first 4 turns of the game. Modern is not like that. You have to actually have something you're doing. And it's possible that I need to lean into my disruption a little more. Like, I didn't think too hard about what lands I wanted. It's possible that I should be playing like a Ghost Quarter Lock or something.
Ooh.
So that I can be interfering with them more. The reason for Fires, it's not so much that I want to pair Fires with Arboreal Grazer. That doesn't excite me. But Tireless Tracker and Escape to the Wilds are cards that will give you plenty of cards, but they take your whole turn to do that. And I don't want to have to take my whole turn to draw cards. That's why I have Fires as kind of a supporting role as a mana engine. It is still a fundamentally fair mid-range-ish, rampish thing. This is not trying to cast Restore Balance or whatever. Like, we're just trying to use the Fires to triple my mana. And I'm going to use that mana in maybe not the most efficient of ways. Like, Cracking Clues is not that efficient. But the hope would be that it makes it somewhat less anemic to be just like, I'm going to make some Tireless Tracker clues and crack them and hope I don't die. Like, I'll get to do that plus cast spells if I have Fires in play. That's the hope. We'll have to see in practice whether that's actually a coherent strategy.
Yeah, it should be interesting.
So that's Modern. I think there's a lot of ways you can go with this. I'm going to start with this build. But David, I know you've been thinking about the Pioneer side of things, what you might do with Fires there.
Yeah, so because Eldraine is so much more powerful than a lot of the sets in Pioneer, you, as Damon and I were kind of jokingly saying, but I think is a legitimate analysis of Pioneer, you can port Eldraine decks with just a few upgrades and a few spots to Pioneer, and they're still very functional and very powerful. So the first list I have proposed is kind of a teamer Fires list that is not that different from the standard list. The mana is a little better because we've got better lands to pick from. Our interaction is a little better and we've got a few extra cards that allow us to draw. But other than that, it's not that different. You're playing the 4 Cavalier of Flame, 4 Cavalier of Gale combo on your top end, if you will. Playing Risen Reef as another way to add lands to the battlefield. And Master of Waves. So Master of Waves sees every blue pip in play and makes an elemental. Those elementals trigger Risen Reef, and then you're already playing this Cavalier of Gales, which has 3 blue pips. Both Cavalier of Flame and Cavalier of Gale are elementals themselves. So you kind of have like a little mini synergy there where even without Fires, even though a lot of these cards are kind of big and dumb and slow, they kind of combine to give you a little bit more than what they normally would. And then in addition to that, I think a card that's really interesting is Sweltering Suns. 1 red-red deals 3 damage to each creature. That's a reasonably playable card. You can play it off of your Fires. But in matchups where it's not good, unlike in all these matchups I was playing today where I had all these Wrath main deck and they didn't get to do anything, this cycles for 3 and you don't mind paying that mana because Fires is going to get to cast whatever spell you draw without paying for it. So you get to kind of play this like sweeper effect when it's good, and then when it's not, it's just basically another way to draw to your Cavalier of Gales or whatever.
Yeah, this looks really interesting. I like the Cavalier package. It seems like it really enables fires, and Growth Spiral is just a very, very strong card. Sometimes Growth Spiral feels literally like Time Walk. It's kind of crazy like that sometimes. I'm curious about the Rogue Refiners, what role they're supposed to play, but Risen Reef plus Master of Waves plus a Cavalier or two, that's a lot of cards you're going to see.
Yeah, I just wanted like another card on three that would draw to get to four, basically. Just another way to kind of cycle through the deck. Rogue Refiner, the mana base I wrote, sketched out, doesn't have it, but it also lets you play
Aether Hub.
Yeah, and Aether Hub is one of the more powerful lands you get to play. It just kind of helps because if you don't get your fires, it is not trivial to be able to like cast Growth Spiral onto, and Cavalier Flame has three red pips. Cavalier of the Gales has three blue pips. Rogue Refiner is just, it replaces itself. It's just, you know, kind of an idiot to get in the way until you sort of assemble your combo.
Did you consider Arboreal Grazer for this deck? The Sloth? Multi-format all-star?
I did not, but maybe I should have. It's a reasonable card. Like Damon said, which I had not ever considered until he said it, is because it doesn't have Defender, it does just start picking up plus one plus O's from Cavalier Flames and whatever, attacking Teferi or attacking your opponent or attacking through 2/2 creature of some kind. So yeah, that's not crazy. I do worry about having enough land drops between if you had four Sloths and four Growth Spirals that they're always going to hit. And obviously Sloth is a really bad draw late in the game, but maybe that's fine.
One thing that the standard deck has is it plays Deafening Clarion instead of the Sweltering Suns. Powerful because it's really like the lifelink mode is actually quite useful on the Cavaliers to really make the game state swing. But yeah, the Arboreal Grazer concept is interesting. I feel like at that point, if you're running a team or a deck with a bunch of Arboreal Grazers, why not just run a bunch of Okos? Grazer just ramps you into Oko and is a good target to become an elk.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's not crazy. You could easily put four Grazer, four Oko in this list and trim the Rogue Refiner, move a few of these cards around. You can get rid of Chandra, Torch of Defiance. Oko's never going to be that wrong in Pioneer, and we are playing the colors that allow you to play Oko. It gives you a plan B that doesn't involve fires at all that we know is like reasonably proactive and powerful.
Yeah, my intuition is we can just cut the Master of Waves. I forget what week it was we tried a list with that card, but I did not have a good experience with it. I understand it's capable of big things, but in practice, it just doesn't seem to pan out very well.
Although that was in Modern. We were playing that in our Risen Reef Thunderkin Awakener decks in Modern.
True.
It was harder to get to board state where that card is relevant. I've seen it do better things in Pioneer. The dream, of course, is to get the Risen Reef and then follow that up with a Master of Waves, which makes elemental tokens.
Yeah, and again, the fact that it's free is really nice. You know, normally the thing that sucks is you have to like play your thing, it has to live, and then you have to play your Master of Waves. But the turn after you play your Fires, you can play a Cavalier of Gales, find a Master of Waves, and play it. And now you've added an insane amount of power to the board if you haven't managed to draw your Cavalier of Flame.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see how it plays out. The Risen Reef, Master of Waves, Cavalier of Flame dream is pretty enticing.
It's not so much that I don't like the card, but I'm just looking at this list. There's not that much room to fit in some of the cards that really excite me, like the blue Sphinx. Sphinx of Foresight seems perfect. This deck is hoping to catch up big time once you land the fires, but there's not really any way to search for the fires. My worry would be that the games where you draw the fires on time, it'll be great, but the other games, it will just put itself pretty far behind. Sphinx goes a long way, I think, towards fixing that, but then that takes away some of your elemental package. You end up getting some competition for slots.
Yeah, we're not playing any op or the two mana card that Dane was talking about that really lets you sort of search to find fires. You're playing 12 cards that cycle, so it makes your deck a little smaller. Sweltering Suns is a card that also cycles. But yeah, I mean, those aren't like search cards in the way that you're meaning.
One lesson from the Mythic Championship is that Andrea Mengucci's list features a mini Risen Reef elemental package, running a total of 12 elementals. 4 Leafkin Druid, 4 Risen Reef, 4 Cavalier of Thorns. It honestly feels slightly more like an 8 elemental package just because Leafkin Druid comes down before Risen Reef does. I suspect that you don't need to have a huge elemental package to leverage the Risen Reef. Perhaps just the Risen Reef and the Cavaliers are enough, and that would clear up some space for Sphinx of Foresight, which I agree with Dan, seems like a good inclusion. Or just maybe swap the Rogue Refiners for Sphinxes.
Yeah, that could easily be done.
I guess trying to squeeze in Grazers and Sphinxes. This might be a tall order.
So yeah, we'll have to tool around with that. The other list I have was inspired by a Ken Yukihiro list that he played at the Mythic Championship. Damon, do you want to give us just a sort of generic concept that Ken Yukihiro was trying to exploit?
Yeah, so Ken Yukihiro had probably the coolest deck of the tournament. The reason is he had a Fires of Invention Niv-Mizzet Reborn deck, and we obviously are lovers of Niv-Mizzet. What's not to love here? The deck features a bunch of kind of traditional Niv-Mizzet gilded hits in the form of Teferi, Time Raveler, Hydroid Krasis, Growth Spiral, Escape to the Wilds, which we already are interested in, along with Casualties of War, which is a standard staple at this point, but has not seen huge play in Pioneer or Modern. Two black, green, green sorcery, so six mana total. Choose one or more, destroy target artifact, creature, enchantment, land, or planeswalker. In the right sort of board state, this card can be up to a 5/1. The dream of this deck is to basically land a Fires on 4, a Niv on 5, and then on turn 6 go casualties, and just completely wreck your opponent's side of the battlefield. Alongside this as enablers in Gilded Goose and Paradise Druid to help ramp out the Fires.
In that dream scenario, Fires on 4, Niv on 5, you get to cast another 5-mana spell on that same turn, which is what makes the combination of Fires and Niv so insane together. It's not like you tap out for Niv and hope to untap and leverage those spells. Like, you can actually cast something else right away. So I think that's what's really exciting about Niv-Mizzet Reborn in conjunction with Fires.
Yeah, it really lets you build a different sort of Niv deck than we're used to in Modern. The Modern deck really needs to keep all of the spells besides Niv to be these kind of lean one-for-one interactions, because you have to basically be able to kind of untap after you play the Niv and double spell. Whereas Fires lets you, as you mentioned, cheat on double spelling both the turn you play the Niv and the turn after, and so you can afford to be playing much beefier spells than a typical Niv shell would.
The other thing that we've been glossing over so far, but that this list really brings to the forefront, is that Fires of Invention is a mana fixer in addition to a mana doubler or tripler. It just checks the quantity of lands you have in play. It doesn't care what colors you're able to make from your lands. So really greedy gold spells, color-intensive spells like Niv-Mizzet Reborn or Casualties of War, that's no problem with the Fires of Invention. As long as you have 5 lands or 6 lands, it just says go nuts. And I think the Cavaliers as well, being triple-colored, triple-pipped creatures, also benefit greatly from the mana-fixing element of the Fires. We haven't really talked much about Niv and Pioneer on the cast. As much as we love Niv-Mizzet, I've felt like the mana is so depressing in Pioneer when trying to make all 5 colors. But Fires of Invention is actually a really explosive way to not only fix your mana for Niv-Mizzet, but also give you as much mana as you could want to cast all these things.
So Kenyu Kihiro's list didn't actually have that many Niv hits. His list was really a Fires list first and kind of a Niv list second. There have been some Niv lists that have had some success. There's been a couple lists, every other deck dump or so, somebody 5-0s. They've kind of established, you know, generic curves and some of the things you can do with mana. So I try to sort of mash those two concepts together. This is a list that can reasonably, and I'm using that term pretty loosely, cast Niv is the old-fashioned way, the honest American way, but it also has the sort of Fires list with it. You need to play Rogue Refiner on 3 to kind of support your Other Hub package. Other Hub being Rainbow Land is really important to casting Niv fairly. Because Attune with Aether is so bad with Fires, I'm only playing 1. I've seen lists that have played up to 4. You're still playing the 4 Goose and 2 Oko to kind of support the food mana package. And then as you go up the chain, you get to play a bunch of cards. But the one I'm most excited about is Scarab God. So it's an actual hit for Niv-Mizzet because it's blue-black, a Dimir card. But it has a mana sink ability that basically allows you... So one of the things that sucks about the Fires interaction is you can't use it with Bring to Light. The interaction that we've sort of exploited that Dan discovered a million years ago is that Niv kind of finds the next Niv because it finds the Bring to Light, and the Bring to Light also finds whatever you want. You can't do that if you're hoping to cast Fires. But if you play Scarab God with Fires in play, it functions as a Bring to Light to find Niv because they've probably killed a Niv-Mizzet. So it just gets it out of your graveyard. You have the mana free. You're also playing Rogue Refiner, which is another great card to target with your Scarab God. It comes back as a 4/4. It replenishes your energy and it draws a card. Scarab God kind of checks a lot of boxes that the Cavaliers were checking in the other list, but it's also a card that Niv can find. So I'm kind of excited about that interaction specifically.
You're going to make a zombie goose. 4/4 eternal goose.
Comes with food.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the Scarab God is absolutely a sweet, sweet magic card. I am not sure of it in an environment with a lot of Okos because Oko is this card's nemesis. But it's true that Fires lets you use it immediately, and so it gives it an effective ETB in a sense. A single activation of it is actually quite strong if there's a good target.
I like how you have the Casualties of War in here. Pioneer, in many ways, is closer to a standard format than a Modern format. The way that Casualties of War can just mop up whatever is happening on the other side of the board was really on impressive display last weekend, and I'm excited to see how that goes here, because normally our Golgari slots in a Niv-Mizzet deck, well, we're looking at Assassin's Trophies, maybe Abrupt Decay, or maybe like a Vraska or something. Casualties of War just gets all, get everything, just cleans up whatever has happened on the other side of the battlefield. That's a card that I'm excited to see what it can pull off in this build.
Yeah, what I wonder is, could we take a lesson from Kenyuku Hiro's list? This is what Dave was alluding to. Kenyuku Hiro's list only plays 17 gilded cards, which is normally quite low for Niv, and with our modern list, I would be very uncomfortable. I fight hard to keep the number of non-gilded cards to an absolute minimum. However, if Fires is letting you gear more towards kind of big spells like Casualties of War, in the modern build hits you like a Helix, an Abrupt Decay, and a Teferi, if you hit a single Casualties in this Pioneer build, like that does the same as all three of those together. It's okay if your Niv hit is hitting you fewer cards as long as they're big ones. And so I wonder if that lets us change the deck building considerations a little bit. I'm not sure it should. I think this is a different way to do it, but where perhaps you play more kind of green ramp cards that are not gilded.
Sylvan Caryatid?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely considered you could play like the Beanstalk Giant that Dan had in his other list as well. That also pays you off for having a lot of lands late in the game. The question is always like, do you want Wrath effects? And if you do, you need to really be careful about what sweeping effects you put into play. If you're counting on Sylvan Caryatid or Gilded Goose to be a mana source, you don't want to play too many Sweltering Suns. I think there's only one actual Wrath effect in here, a single Supreme Verdict. But if you get too cavalier with those, you'll find yourself without all your sweet creatures you spend so much time playing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty different world having one Verdict in the list with or without Bring to Light. Here, you really do just have the one.
Right.
I wonder if you could put in just kind of a few more big mana cards in here with or without the ramp. Like, for example, Kenrith and Fires is just a really strong interaction. It's kind of like an additional copy of the Scarab God.
Or Golo's Tireless Pilgrim and Fires, which is something that I think Shota Yasuoka brought with him in his five-color Fires build for the Mythic Championship.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea, both of those.
Yeah, I mean, the other big card is the Escape to the Wilds. I'm not sure if there's any that are in the Pioneer card pool that we're not seeing in the Standard card pool in kind of like this big game gilded card space.
Well, there's one that I want to mention, Oath of Teferi, the 5-mana legendary enchantment, 3 blue-white. When Oath of Teferi enters the battlefield, exile another permanent you control, and it comes back at your end step. So it's a slow blink. It allows you to activate the loyalty abilities of your planeswalkers twice each turn instead of once. You mentioned this, your nemesis, Dave, the guy who plays the Jeskai Planeswalker deck. This is probably the Fires deck that people are familiar with. You could find a bunch of lists that people have 5-0 with Jeskai Planeswalkers with Fires of Invention. That list, whatever the Planeswalker angle is doing, it has some interesting little tricks, and Oath of Teferi is one of them. We mentioned that Fires of Invention restricts you to 2 spells a turn, but if you can find a way to hide your Fires for a turn, you can actually get around that 2-spell restriction. The 2 ways to do that are commonly played are this Oath of Teferi. You can blink the Fires. It'll sort of chill on the sidelines until your end step. Play 2 spells for free. The second one is the Oath, and then you can cast even more spells, then your Fires comes back later. Teferi Time Raveler also works that way. Teferi Time Raveler can blink an enchantment, so if there's a turn where you actually have a bunch of spells you want to cast, cast 2 of them for free off the Fires. Teferi Downtick, bounce your Fires. Now you're good to cast more spells. You're no longer working under the restriction. Elements like that, I think we might want to put a few more options like that into the build, just in case that comes up.
Casualties of War is also used in that capacity sometimes, where it's used to destroy all the other permanents on your opponent's side if they possess them, but you destroy your own enchantment, you cast a couple other spells after you've kind of gotten your 12 mana's worth out of your Fires, and then maybe you can actual hard cast Fires at the end of you using all 8 mana you have in play, for instance, or something.
Yeah, I forgot about that. That's nice.
As we know, when you start putting Niv-Mizzet Reborn in your list, the decision trees get really endless as far as what cards you want to cast at each spot in the curve, and then it gets sort of exponentially more complicated when you want to play Fires. You can make your deck a much better Niv-Mizzet deck. You can make your deck a much better Fires deck. You can make your deck a much better ramp deck. So yeah, I think these are all super interesting options, and it's going to take a lot of fiddling with what actually feels powerful enough and what doesn't. The decision tree gets super complex very quickly when you're talking about cards that allow so much freedom in terms of spell selection.
A question for you. So we've talked about how in Modern, the game is usually over if you've resolved Niv-Mizzet. So the battle is fought before you resolve Niv-Mizzet. Will they kill you first, or will they stop you from resolving Niv? Where do you think Pioneer sits on that spectrum? Do you think that the challenge is going to be not dying before you can pull off a Niv-Mizzet, or is it going to be not having the opponent go over the top of you after you resolve Niv-Mizzet?
I think the opponent going over the top of you is only the 2 specific decks that we're talking about. about, the Lotus Storm deck and the Infinite Turns deck. Those are both strategies that you basically aren't interacting with at all. In that sense, I guess that would be my biggest worry, but I don't think that's that large of a percentage of the card pool. I think Niv-Mizzet's ability to like get cards and turn those cards into material on the board is actually powerful enough for Pioneer. As tempo-driven as it is, Niv-Mizzet being a 6-6 is even more important in a format where there's lots of like 5-5 beaters attacking, which is not a thing that's very common in Modern.
Yeah, well, actually, going back to the blue-green Nexus deck, is that the modern version of Niv we have would laugh that deck off because of this secret card, Unmoored Ego, naming Nexus of Fate. Maybe we should never take a Niv list out into the wild without one of those cards somewhere in the 75.
Yeah, I mean, the difference is you guys are playing, depending on the list, four ways to tutor it or three ways to tutor it. So you functionally get to play four main deck.
Yeah.
Just putting one in your main deck is actually pretty weak.
On the other hand, Niv does dig 10 cards. And so you will find singletons a little bit more than you would normally, even without the Bring to Light package.
True. So I definitely think that's the way you'd have to fight it is you have to play like multiple of those in your board probably to get the advantage that you'd need. And then you'd likely get a turn five in most games against these combo decks. So if you can get Niv-Mizzet to resolve and you have a Fires in play, you even get to cast it that turn. So I think that's what you'd have to kind of count on.
We could play Bring to Light, right?
Yeah, you absolutely could.
Maybe not as many because it doesn't work as well with Fires, but it is a functional card still.
Yeah, Fires of Invention is a may ability. It says you may cast a spell without paying mana, but you don't have to. If you want to pay your mana for it, you're allowed to do so under the Fires. It will still count against your two spells for the turn. So Bring to Light will use up both of that. You'll cast the Bring to Light, and then Bring to Light also cast the card that it finds. So that'll be your only thing you do that turn, but it does still work. The reason why you might not want to do that is because the Simic slots are already pretty full in this list. Growth Spiral becomes super important with Fires of Invention, lets you make a land drop. And then you also have cards like Rogue Refiner, like Dave's saying, very important for getting the Aether Hubs to work. And then Oakothief of Crowns is hard to pass on. So this is already playing 10 Simic cards, which is more than I'm really comfortable with in a Niv list. But finding room for a Bring to Light or two is something to consider.
I think it's okay to go a little bit denser on Simic. Again, like I think that having a smaller Niv hit, if Niv hits two cards and it's a Bring to Light and a Casualties of War, I think that's actually totally acceptable if you have a Fires in play. In the modern build, hitting only two cards is like kind of a whiff. But if the cards are that high power, high impact, that seems okay. When Niv hits the 10-card pile and the pile has, you know, three Growth Spirals and a Bring to Light, I don't think you'll feel that bad about bottoming the Growth Spirals.
I'll feel bad. It'll be a hollow victory because I didn't get the full value. Okay, anything else we want to say about this Niv Fires list?
That looks sweet.
Yeah, I'm super excited to cast Niv for no mana on turn five, and then just like every spell I flip is a spell I can cast that turn, basically. That just sounds like a kid in a candy store type of scenario that I've been wanting to live my entire life.
I mean, this deck looks amazing. I want to give a quick shout out to one of our listeners, Lawson Zandy. I was just watching him stream a deck very similar to this today, actually. I'll put a link to his stream in the show notes. He streams a lot of interesting decks, including variations on Niv-Mizzet, and he was trying out an Escape to the Wilds Fires Niv Pioneer deck that was, it looked hilarious. It was an even greedier version of this deck in many ways. So,
gotta love that greed.
Lots of ways to customize this and try to figure out the exact configuration that will just overwhelm the opponent. I'm excited to take this one of the queues and see how it does. All right, well, I think we've got plenty of fuel for the fires. Really cool lists going in a bunch of different directions. We'll post these all in the show notes. And of course, any listeners, if you have some ideas of your own for fires in Modern or Pioneer, send them our way and we'd love to take a look. We will check back next week with our results and a new card. Take care, gentlemen.
All right, see ya.
Take it easy.
That'll do it for this edition of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. You can find all of the deck lists from today's show in the episode description of your podcast player. Faithless Brewing is a listener-supported show. If you like what you heard and would like to contribute directly, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. All patrons get access to our Discord channel and other cool rewards. You can also find us on Twitter at faithlessmtg, email us faithlessbrewing@gmail.com, or our homepage faithlessbrewing.podbean.com. We rely on brewers like you to help us improve the show and bring you better content. So give us a follow, tell a friend, and we will see you next week.